I would now like to welcome Professor Carl Qualls, Chair of the History Department, to the podium.
Thank you all. I love to see standing room only crowds. This is a very good thing. Unfortunately, for those of you standing, it's not so good of a thing. First of all, I'd like to thank a group of people. First, Elaine Mellon in the History Department and Jolie Rankin in the Clark Forum for their tireless administrative work in helping us to put this together. I'd also like to thank the Clark Forum, Americana Studies Group, Office of Diversity Initiatives, and the Departments of Anthropology and Religion for helping us to fund our program tonight. This is the History John Flom Lecture Series, our annual history lecture series. Professor Flom taught history at Dickinson College from 1946 to 1972 with interest in the Civil War, European origins of the First World War, and early Carlisle history. He held several different awards, one for distinguished teaching, the Lindbach Award from the college, in recognition of his popularity with students. He remained for all of his life a really voracious reader and a devourer of history, memoir, biography, and prose literature. But he was really a born teacher and a fanatical teacher who was devoted to his students for several generations of Dickinsonians. His teaching placed an emphasis on precision and fact and evidenced love of conventional art and literature. His enthusiasm and dedication are described best in his own words. He said, quote, "The sheer pleasure of teaching, the fun I've had in the average class, this is what I remember more than anything else. My heart is in the lecture room. It's almost a shame to take money." But of course, he did take the money like we all do. This lecture series is given in his name and was established by the monetary donations on retirement from his colleagues, former students, and friends. Our speaker tonight is the 25th speaker in the Flom Lecture Series, which has brought renowned scholars and public figures to Dickinson College since 1971, from all across the United States, from England, from Spain, and from Germany. To make our induction tonight is our African historian, Jeremy Ball, who recommended Dr. Sane to us and has done so much in helping us to host and to schedule this event for us tonight. So, Jeremy, please.
Before I begin to introduce our distinguished guest, let me just say that it's a very exciting time to be and to study Africa and the African diaspora at Dickinson. We've had a number of exciting events this year. We had our second annual Africana Studies film series and the Ashubi Craig Group taught us African drumming. Next week is Africa Week on campus. So please get involved with all of these Africa events. And of course, tonight we welcome one of the leading scholars of religion and the abolition movement in West Africa, Professor Lamin Sane. Professor Sane is a professor of history and world Christianity at Yale University. He has written a number of books related to religion in Africa, including most recently, Whose Religion is Christianity? The Gospel Beyond the West, The Crown and the Turban, Muslims and West African Pluralism, Religion and the Variety of Culture, A Study in Origin and Practice, and West African Christianity, The Religious Impact. He has also written Abolitionists Abroad, American Blacks and the Making of Modern West Africa. In addition, he has authored over 100 articles on religious and historical subjects. Sane is honorary research professor in the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London and is a life member of Clare Hall at Cambridge University. He was chairman of Yale's Council on African Studies and is a member of the board of the Institute for Advanced Christian Studies. He has served on the boards of ethics and public policy at Harvard and the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute in Birmingham, Alabama. Sane has also served as a consultant to the Pew Charitable Trust and was an official consultant at the 1998 Lambeth Conference of the Anglican Church and was appointed by Pope John Paul II to the Pontifical Commission for the Historical Sciences. For his academic work, Sane was made commander of the National Order of the Lion, which is Senegal's highest national honor. Professor Sane comes originally from the Gambia, and he is descended from the Nyachos, an ancient African royal house. He received his PhD in Islamic history from the University of London, and it is my great honor to welcome Dr. Sane to Dickinson.
Thank you very much, Jeremy, for your welcome. Jeremy forgot to say that if you're interested in Africana Studies, there is apparently a restaurant downtown that where they serve wonderful peanut butter soup for lunchtime. Gastronomic enticement never fails with students, if I may speak from my own experience. Thank you very much for your welcome and for inviting me to Dickinson College, which I visited many, many years ago when I was an undergraduate in the United States during the height of the civil rights movement. I don't know what I was doing here, but this is a good place, and I found myself wandering the grounds of Dickinson College. The question really we face tonight, which I want to explore with you, is in a post-9/11 world, is religion safe? Many of us have our minds made up about that question. Some of us would say, no, religion is not safe and has never been safe, and 9/11 is proof of that. And others would say, well, maybe we ought to revisit the question in the light of 9/11. I remember shortly after I arrived at Yale, I received a letter from the Russian Academy of Sciences inviting me to a conference in Moscow on the theme of the conference, which was the problem of religion. The Iron Curtain had come down, the Cold War had ended, and Russian scholars were beholding the spectacle of the resurgence of religion at a time when they thought religion had ended, had finished. And hence the question, the problem of religion, as if they were surprised and taken aback by religion having survived the Soviet period. In my view, as an historian of religion, we live today in extraordinary times. Many in my generation of undergraduates were familiar, I think, with the anti-Vietnam War demonstrations which are going on and the civil rights movement and the upheaval throughout this nation following the Watergate scandal. And I remember I went into my undergraduate years dealing with Siddhartha, you know, the great book about Buddhism, and reading Gunter Grass, The Tin Drum. We were still sort of mulling over the aftermath of the Second World War. And I remember as an undergraduate taking off from America and landing in Germany, in Munich. Again, I don't know what I was doing there. But one morning I decided to go on a tour of one of the concentration camps, Dachau. I'm an historian, I think, by instinct. And what was I doing in Dachau, you might ask, in the concentration camps? And I was reflecting on what is the meaning of history? Are we going somewhere worth going? What is the meaning of the Second World War for historical study and understanding? And after 9/11, I think many Americans found themselves in a similar situation. I happened to be visiting Fargo, North Dakota, a few days after 9/11, where I was speaking to an assembly of townspeople led by the mayor of Fargo, North Dakota. I had visited a plant, a glass-making factory in Fargo, which produces is Cardinal Glass. They are the largest manufacturers of domestic glass, the window glasses that we see. And the young fellow who was the plant manager, a guy called David, a graduate of West Point, said to me, I have 22 different nationalities here in my plant making glass. And of those 22 nationalities, the vast majority are Muslim. Muhammad, one of the workers on the plant in the assembly line, he called him. He said, well, Muhammad is reluctant to come because he loves his work so much. He had left Saddam Hussein's Iraq and come to the United States was in Fargo, North Dakota. I didn't realize that Fargo was such a gathering point of immigrant groups arriving in the United States. Fargo, it turns out, is one of the most multicultural cities in America. I had no idea. David said to me, I probably fought this guy, because David was in the first Gulf War, 1991. And wasn't it astonishing that one of Saddam Hussein's soldiers, whom David probably fought, was now working in a factory in North Dakota, where David was the plant manager. He gave me a cap. I should have brought that cap. I really wear it with pride. That's the meaning, in a sense, of America. America never stands still. So in the light of 9/11, Americans began to brood and to ask themselves three fundamental questions. What has America done to deserve this? 9/11, what have we done? And the second question was, who are these people? Who are they? And the third question was, what can we do about it? What can we do about it? Now those questions are, of course, interrelated. What has America done? What have we done as Americans to deserve this? Because if we know, then we can correct, we can change, we can alter. That's the basis of the question. And the second question, who are these people? Well, it will help us, rather than thrashing about and hitting at the world, it would help us to know exactly and precisely who these people are. Now, I was traveling through America at that time, and I was really impressed and amazed at how restrained people were. I arrived in Minneapolis at the airport, Northwest Airlines. The guy who was helping me at the checkout, remember, this is a few days after 9/11, was a guy called Muhammad, the Muslim fellow who was checking me in for my flight in Minneapolis. And it seems to me that this idea of America, that we must find out who these people are, is sort of, let us not go on a witch hunt. Let us determine exactly who these people are. And the third question, what can we do about it? Who are these people? What can we do about it? Means that certain options are not open to us, are not available. And that question, what can we do about it, is what I want to bring before you tonight. And I was really delighted to hear that there will be a question and answer. It's something that I really value extremely. And I will therefore use my clock, my watch, and I will stop if I need to stop mid-sentence in order to allow time for question and answer. An important feature of the post-9/11 world is the place of religion in world history. And especially for policymakers in Washington, D.C., where I spent a year recently, the question is really very important about the balance of power in an era of widespread political challenge and cultural conflict. And nowhere is that problem more acute than in the encounter with radical Islam and its new homebred manifestations in the West. Radical Islam, as opposed to moderate Islam, has spread across national boundaries. And what is no less baffling is that it has taken root in areas of social advantage and mobility in the West. And that defies arguments of deprivation, poverty, geographical alienation, and lack of access as causal factors of radicalism. It also means that radicalism, especially the suicide violence it spawns, is not necessarily inhibited by a culture of opportunity and openness, which leaves a pressing question about how the radical momentum can be diverted into peaceful and constructive channels. With the advantage of historical proximity, world Christianity is rising in tandem with the rise of radical Islam. And it seems to me an important question about the resurgence of Christianity around the world, how Christians relate to Muslims under the challenge or against the challenge of radical Islam. And this coincidence, convergence with the flow of radical Islam means that the return of religion for many ordinary people also means the return of uncertainty and instability with the outbreak of new cultural tensions and conflicts. I began, by the way, studying this phenomenon of radicalism, I suppose with the Iranian Revolution of 1979, because I was particularly interested in a phenomenon in Islam called millennialism, which is the idea that at the end of every century, God will send a good person who will reform the affairs of religion for the people and set things right and fill the world or the earth with justice and righteousness as the world is filled now with injustice and unrighteousness. And this sentiment goes back many, many, many centuries, so that at the turn of every Islamic century, there has been upheaval and violence. And before 1979, the millennial upheaval in the century before was the Sudanese Mahdia, which set Victorian England astir. If you remember, Gordon, who lost his life in Khartoum, became really the poster boy of Western innocence in the face of radicalism. And 1979 is important for us because that's the first time that radical ideology targeted the United States as the great Satan, the great enemy. See, before then, America has never really been an imperial power in the Muslim world in the way, say, Russia was, or the French, or the British. And America ranged itself on the side of the Arab world during the Cold War. If you remember the Suez Canal crisis from your literature, from reading, when Gamal Abdel Nasser socialized, took over the Suez Canal, and you remember the Israelis and the French and the British went to war against Nasser to retain control of the Suez Canal, it was the United States that actually sided with Egypt against Israel, against Britain, against the French. As a result of that American intervention on the side of Nasser, Nasser was able to regain control of the Suez Canal. And one result of that was that the government of Anthony Eden, conservative government in London, collapsed. And what kind of response did America get for siding against the imperialists on the side of Nasser and the Arab world was that America was pilloried in the United Nations as a neo-colonial power, which is one reason why Americans became very unsure, very uncertain about their role in the Cold War in terms of the non-alignment movement headed by Nasser and Nehru of India and Indonesia and other places. But history is very, very important for us to remember why Americans became suspicious of the United Nations, because they felt they had gone to all this trouble to support the Arab world against aggression, and yet they get rewarded with attacks. And I believe it was Arthur Goldberg, who was the United States ambassador in the United Nations, used to be dragged the floor of the United Nations and pilloried and attacked and so forth and so on. So Americans became confused, uncertain about to what extent they should support the United Nations. I think you should remember that you know, that history was very much part of American distrust of the UN. but in any case, the resurgence which is taking place today, both in radical Islam and in other aspects of religious growth and development, has been a very troubling one for many people in the West. Some people in the West see a direct link between, on the one hand, intolerance and strife, and on the other, resurgence and radicalism. Others see a major civilizational threat in the return of religion, while secular advocates interpret the new ferment as evidence of the ravages of rampant secularization in centers of traditional religious life. Confident that the drama of radicalism is really only the last gasp of religion in its dying throes. These three scenarios of intolerance, conflict, and rampant secularism are united in the view that religion is the problem, as the Russian Academy put it. The West is at a crucial crossroads in its relations with Islam generally conceived. As the speech of Pope Benedict XVI in Regensburg in Germany in September 2006 illustrated, the issue is not new when we think about it. When in the 1740s, Frederick the Great of Prussia formed the first Lancer unit from Tatar Muslim soldiers who had deserted from the Russian army, leading eventually to some 1,000 Muslim soldiers serving in Prussia. Frederick did so from his commitment to Enlightenment ideals of religious toleration. Frederick the Great proceeded to allocate a prayer room for the use of Muslim troops, but on Sundays. Now, the point about that is that Muslims don't have Sunday as a day of worship. But he was using his familiarity with Christianity to sort of project Islam in the same way. Friday is the day of assembly for Muslims, not Sunday. It just shows you how little help your Enlightenment ideas are when it comes to Islam. Frederick's attempt to make concessions to Islam left him, therefore, in a very awkward position. He construed worship as a Sunday affair and did not understand the simple rule of Islam about the five daily prayers or Friday simply as the day of assembly, Yom al-Jumu'ah, which did not tie Muslims to abstaining from work on Fridays. More relevantly, however, Frederick added a Muslim cemetery built in Berlin, which was renovated in 1866. Through ups and downs, the Muslim community survived in Germany, and after 1951, they created an organization, a Geistliche Verwaltung, which continues to operate even today. For all his Enlightenment inclinations, Frederick the Great and his successors stopped short of instituting Sharia Islamic law. That happened only in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, following the absorption of large Muslim populations of Ottoman Bosnia-Herzegovina in 1878, the government in Vienna in 1909 incorporated the region into the central imperial system. And in 1912, it passed an act granting recognition to the Hanafite branch of Sharia law. And this was extended to all Muslim communities of the empire, not just to those in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The way was paved by the German translation of the Hanafi Code of Muslim Family Law, published in Vienna in 1883. And in 1979, that legal framework was renewed, and Austrian law applied Islamic family law in its courts in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The real issue is the fundamental religious claim that the divine law, the Sharia in Islam, and political ordinances, what in the Ottoman Empire were called the Qawanun, that these rules and norms from religion define the norms of a well-ordered society, which in the radical view is the prototype of the heavenly city. One sort of simplification of this is to say that whereas most Americans pray thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, the radical view would be that thy will be done in earth, in heaven as we make it on earth. So that the radical interest is to create a kind of ideal utopian achievement here on earth that would be replicated in heaven. And this is it's a very important difference, I think, in the radical view of Islam. Sayyid Hussein Nasr, the great philosopher of Islam, used to say, when I was still a graduate student, that the danger, the temptation facing Muslims is their unwillingness to wait for paradise, but rather to strive to achieve paradise here on earth. And in a sense, the radicals have taken that clue and made it into a project, a program. In that view, in the view of the radicals, religion must combat the falsehood that truth can have no higher claim than the legislative mandate. There were really two items in the revolution of modernity for the radicals that they want to contest and, if possible, reverse. The one is the political principle that the source of sovereignty for government is the will of the people. That you consult the people, and in an election, what they decide becomes then paramount, and that's what you abide by. This notion of sovereignty, abiding in the people, conflicts with the radical view that only God is sovereign. And therefore, God's will must trump legislatures, political assemblies, political norms. The second major revolution of modernity is the notion that the nation state, the country, the nation, is the object of our loyalty and allegiance. That we fight for the nation, we defend it, and we even die for it. And this then makes the nation an object of worship in the radical ideology. And therefore, the question of citizenship, for example, conflicts with their notion of the brotherhood and the sisterhood of believers, which transcends national boundaries. The Salman Rushdie controversy about the satanic verses, I think, demonstrates clearly the limits of national sovereignty for this religious controversy about authority and legitimacy. And I don't need to tell you that for the West and for the secular West, these are almost, you might say, non-negotiable positions. It's really hard to imagine Americans or anyone else saying, well, we go to an election, but, you know, we really know what is better for the people than the people themselves. So we needn't really abide by the results of an election, as it were. We can take the people and assemble them, but ultimately, when we want to pass laws, we can decide on the basis of whatever grounds are available what is good for the people. Now, this notion then of secular authority and autonomy is unacceptable to the radical fringe among the Muslims. It is the case in classical Muslim religious thought, for example, that religion is viewed not simply in its positive sense as an influence in bidding to honor Amar bi Ma'ruf, but also in its negative sense as an instrument for prohibiting dishonor, Nahi an al-Munkar. And the conflict with the Western secular tradition is really inevitable, because in the West, only the secular state is entitled to the role of public instrument. For example, in Sharia law, women and slavery belong to the domestic side of life. Right? In Western law, religion, slavery, and even women really belong to public issues, the public domain. And so the reversal of this tradition creates a conflict of law, which is one of the reasons we even in America, don't really know what to do with polygamy. In the recent terrible fire in New York City in the Bronx, Sumare, who lost his wife and five children, is polygamous, right? But we've suspended any discussion of that so far. Maybe the time will come when we'll discuss it. But you see what I mean? For us in America, we say, well, polygamy should be part of public law. Whereas in Muslim society, polygamy really belongs to the domestic, in the same way that slavery belongs to the domestic sphere of law, as such. In any case, conflict seems to me to be inevitable, given these grounds. In the United States, the courts, the legislatures, banks, taxation, property, employment, press and media, the armed services, town and city life, for example, reflect the primacy of the secular organization of life and the pattern of religious neutrality it stamps on the rest of society. It is really, for me, an interesting question whether, for example, heartland Islam, that is to say, the strongholds of Islam in the Muslim world, can be reformed from the margins of the West. Can we, for instance, imagine the Orange County Muslim community wafting the breath of a laid-back congeniality in devotion and practice on radical corridors in the Muslim world? That'd be interesting, because then the diaspora communities in America would have a role in modernizing and moderating and influencing developments in the wider Muslim world. We confront in this situation several questions. Can radical outbreaks in the West itself, in Birmingham in England, in Bradford, in Leicester, in Finsbury Park in London, in so many other places, in Madrid, even in Paris, can these outbreaks be contained? What role can the West play in the liberal reconstruction of religion globally? Can heartland Islam be reformed? What is the special responsibility of historical inquiry into creating a liberal temper, a liberal environment for the study of religion? The radicals demand, for example, that we make a distinction in the United States about minority-majority, and we calculate those quantitatively in terms of numbers, right? That's how we calculate issues, and the majority, therefore, is given more weight than the minority. The radicals have a creed, which is very, very important, which is to say that the moral vocation is never a majority vocation. The idea of the moral majority is a contradiction in terms, because they say that moral reform is always a minority vocation. Only the minority can undertake reform that changes society. In other words, change must come at society from the outer perimeter, from the margins, to attack the center and the status quo. And so you think of bin Laden in the caves of Tora Bora, or in desert camps, these training camps that are facilitated in really very harsh environments. And there, ideas of revolution and reform are incubated to attack centers of city life, centers of military power, economic power. And this has tremendous appeal among young radical people who are trying to follow their leaders and are disenchanted with the process of westernization going on in their societies. And so this dichotomy, this polarization, that a minority vocation is necessarily moral, and that the smaller the number, the more unrepresentative the radicals are of the majority, the better suited they are to carry out these moral reforms. Now, I'm saying this because we take a kind of sociological view of this minority-majority distinction, one that the radicals do not make. And for them, in fact, this radical minority-majority distinction should really be a distinction between submission and rebellion, or faith and apostasy. And that is then construed as actionable, something you actually deal with, rather than just float it up as a kind of neutral, objective observation. Ah, yeah, we can see the majority there, we can see the minority there. And anyone writing in our papers today can sort of hold forth about, yeah, these radicals are a minority, they are unrepresentative, a kind of mantra which we repeat. And we don't realize that that very repetition is exactly what the radicals themselves would make. They would hate to be the majority. They would hate to be representative of Muslims, whom they consider the rest of the Muslims, whom they consider corrupt, untrustworthy, and therefore dangerous for their particular project. For us, in the West, religion is a matter of choice. It's what you opt and decide to do, right? Whereas for the radicals, religion is not about being punctilious in observance, being faithful in devotion. I went to a boarding school. It was a government boarding school, and very regimented. Our daily routine was governed by the religious routine. We started at 4 o'clock in the morning. Can you believe? Students complain about chapel once a week, and that's even at 11 o'clock in the morning. We started at 4 in the morning. By 5 o'clock, we said our prayers, cleaned up, got ready for school. Second prayers at midday, cleaned up, had lunch. Third prayers at 5 in the afternoon, games. Fourth prayer at sunset, and fifth prayer before bedtime. And you do this 7 days a week, you know, every week of the month, 12 months a year. There is no, it doesn't get fewer the more you do it. And this distinction I'm saying, this observance, being punctilious in observance, is irrelevant to the radicals. I had a roommate in Beirut when I was a student at the American University, who was very active in the Palestinian struggle, Shafiq. He would consider himself a radical, but he would not hold himself necessarily tied to observance of the 5 daily prayers as such. So observance is not relevant to the radical ideology. And I say this because many of us in America say, well, this person is not religious because they are not really, they are secular. You know, we say this. They drink, they don't go to church, and they don't really care much for religion, they don't read the Bible. But I don't think you can make that distinction with the radicals, clearly. And Fuad Ajami tells a story in a book he published last year about how he arrived in Iraq, and Ayatollah Sistani received him and welcomed him. Fuad Ajami is a Shiite from Beirut. And Ajami relates in this book how he was scared stiff that Sistani might ask him to pray with him. And he said because he wouldn't know what to do and how to do it. And yet Sistani received him, right, received him, but would refuse to receive Americans to give them audiences, even though in a sense it's the American security umbrella that has allowed him the freedom. So I think it's very important for us not to be misled by our very finely tuned definitions of religion about where the radicals stand vis-a-vis the West. In the West, as I say, choice trumps natural entitlement. And the availability of numerous religious options fruit salad approach, a cafeteria approach to religion, really defines the attitude in the West. Religion is a matter of taste, whereas for the radicals, religion is a matter for the state. And this radical prescription for establishment, against establishment secularism, is a fundamental challenge. And the headscarf controversy in France demonstrates this. I say to my Muslim friends, you are absolutely right to contest the French position on the headscarf. And I said, what you're doing also is to reveal that secularism itself is really a form of religion. So that secular fundamentalism really cannot complain if in reaction to it there arises religious fundamentalism. There are really two fundamentalisms. And French secular fundamentalism deserves radical Muslim fundamentalism. It doesn't deserve moderate Islamic response, because what is moderate Islam going to respond to except to give in and to compromise? So I'm far more impatient with my French friends on this than I am with the radical on the Muslim side. In Britain, there are 1.6 million Muslims, and there have been calls in Britain for Muslim representation in Parliament to be greater than the present number of 4 MPs. According to Muslim leaders, including the Assistant Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police and Britain's most senior Muslim police officer, Muslims are entitled to 20 members of Parliament to reflect their number in the country. In the meantime, while acknowledging tolerance and respect for Muslims in a post-77 Britain, there have been attempts by many of the leaders in Britain to note that British Muslims still feel more resentful, more alienated, and more suspicious than Muslims polled in Germany, France, and Britain. And that's the point I was trying to make earlier, that the liberties, political freedom, political choice, does not seem to inhibit radicalism. In fact, it seems to allow it to fester. There are any number of forces that are really competing with radical Islam to bring Western culture down. Look at the fertility rates in European countries. The fertility rates, for example, for Italy and for Spain are 1.2%. For Germany, 1.3%. For Sweden, 1.5%, according to a report by the World Economic Forum. For a population to renew itself in any country, you need to have at least 2.1% fertility rate. And these numbers are really very, very far behind that. In other words, Europe will soon run out of people at this rate. You know, there will not be enough people. And first of all, there will be not enough people employed to pay for Social Security. So you're going to get collapse and decline on that side. I have friends in Denmark and Sweden who say that it's Muslim doctors who emigrate to these countries with their large families whom they can afford to support because they get paid more for carrying out abortions in the hospitals. And the irony is quite extraordinary, that the resources being used to help replenish Muslim family life are the same resources that are actually undermining Western European populations. In any case, it seems to me quite clear that we are in for a major overhaul of the place of religion in our national life. Mark Liller of the University of Chicago School of, I believe, Social Science, in a review of a book in the New York Times Book Review, reflects on the challenge facing the West, and not just Europe, America, he means, saying the challenge, he says, is of twofold nature. One is the recognition of the importance of faith in the lives of people for many of whom religion offers a political blueprint, thus making accommodation with the secular world well nigh impossible. The implication of this for the West, he says, is the assumption of a universal historical process driving all nations towards secular modernity. But that implication, he says, is illusory. It will not happen. The other challenge, and I quote Mark Liller, is to learn how to distinguish between those whose political programs are inspired by genuine faith and those whose defense of religion is inspired by reactionary utopianism, having less to do with God than with directing the faulty course of history. In radical Islam, we find both phenomena today. Authentic faith, he says, on the one hand, and anti-modern fanaticism, shaking together into an explosive cocktail. And I put it differently. The challenge is whether the West can foster in the Muslim world the idea that Islam and democracy are mutually reinforcing against the exclusive radical ideology of political Islam. Can the West do that without reclaiming its religious heritage by connecting with the Christian resurgence in the non-Western world? Now, I don't think that this resurgence will cure the problem, but it will offer the West an ally in its struggle against radical ideology. David Aikman, who used to be the Time magazine bureau in Peking, in Beijing, in China, wrote a book that some of you may be familiar with called Jesus in Beijing. And there, Aikman, A-I-K-M-A-N, argues that China is undergoing a revolution, a religious conversion, and that in a few decades, the Chinese ruling elite will have converted to Christianity, and that conversion, he says, will translate into a new attitude towards international relations, respect for international treaties, international obligations, concern for the poor, for the rule of law, et cetera, a kind of Augustinian worldview. And Aikman says, probably more as a rhetorical flourish than as a statement of fact, that in time the Christian lamb will tame the Chinese dragon. I don't know if that will happen, but Aikman, in his view, China will then become an ally of the West, and between the West and China, the Middle East, Islam in between, will be forced to change from within. It's an interesting scenario. I don't know if it'll happen, but I have to tell you that Aikman is listened to in Washington, D.C., in many, many halls and corridors of power. So I give you that little bit of news about where things are going in terms of thinking, new flows. I want in my in the last section of my discussion of where things stand after 9/11 to look at, you know, where the new Christian resurgence is taking us, because that has also been one of the most striking developments in the world since the end of colonial rule. The movement of Christian resurgence around the world has implicated many, many structures of life and society. The conversion of Northern Europeans, we should remind ourselves, began a slow process of reform and integration, culminating in the great public institutions and immense streams of literature, philosophy, art, architecture, music, crafts, science, and technology. The Christian story, in that sense today, is faced with a dramatic challenge to this complex heritage from the West. Now, even though many are impressed by the gains of the modern West, they remain suspicious of the religious component of Western culture and civilization. The debate about the determinants of a religious society and about religious pluralism is absolutely relevant to how we conceive our place in the world after 9/11. China is one of the most amazing corridors of the interaction of Christianity and what's left of the Marxist legacy in China. What is so interesting about China was everyone was predicting the end of religion in China in the 1970s. Today, the Chinese authorities in the textbooks authorized for use in schools, history textbooks, all reference to Mao and Marxism are deleted before 1979. In other words, the new China, we used to trump the new China, right, under Mao. This was the new China, has now undergone another turn of a new China, which wants to leave Mao and Marx behind. 1979 was important because 1979 was actually 78, but 79 was the beginning of the government's program and project of reform and change, opening up to the West, leaving behind the baggage of ideological socialism and the command economy. And Chinese leaders began to experiment and to sort of dabble in Christian ideas and Christian values. When I was in Shanghai a few years ago, on the ride from the airport to the university, Fudan, in the taxi was with me was a rabbi from California. I watched him with great interest as his jaw just fell as he listened to our Chinese hosts, two young theologians, telling him how the Chinese are busy translating Jewish philosophical and theological texts into Chinese. He just couldn't believe this. And Fudan University is a national, it's a government university. Right in the middle of the campus, a huge campus, is a huge building called the Center for American Studies. Last week, as I was getting ready for these lectures, I got an email from a former student of mine in Shanghai. He's just been approached last week about establishing an institute for the study of world Christianity at Fudan University in China. And that's why I'm saying to you that this is it's a major development that you and I have to deal with. There is, it seems to me, in the new resurgence that is happening in world Christianity especially, a flashback to the values that helped to shape the image of the young republic that became the United States. The pluralism that Christianity has engendered is really not so far from what you and I would understand as kind of Madisonian pluralism, James Madison's idea, for example, of allowing free competition of ideas in the marketplace of ideas, so that there is not what he would call a powerful combination that dominates society forever and ever, but that there is a constant turnover of ideas and values. This phenomenon is actually being played out in the rest of the world. At that conference at Shanghai that I attended, it was not on the program of the conference, but one of the key subjects people wanted to discuss was the question of church-state relations. Separation of church and state. Quite astonishing if you really think about it. This is not something that Americans are imposing on the Chinese. This is something that Chinese leaders, when they think really about how to deal with the problem of political tyranny and despotism, realize that one of the greatest dangers society faces is when a government anoints itself with the powers of religion. and therefore to achieve the objects of a liberal democracy, church must be separated from the state so that church can take care of the church without the state having a role in that. This, I believe, is one of the central platforms for engaging the new world order that is emerging after 9/11. And I hope that many of you young people here will turn your minds at some point, whether in international relations, political science, history of culture, sociology, philosophy, to this new world order that is going to emerge, that will need to take on the radicals and the radical ideology of exclusivism. Because for you just to say it's none of our business does not mean that the radicals don't have you in their sights. They'll come for you. And the only way we can battle them is not with weapons and guns, is with ideas and with values. Philip Hitti, in his great History of the Arab, said, you can kill a person, but you cannot kill an idea. And I hope the idea of freedom, of liberty, of the pursuit of righteousness, to call the American Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of righteousness, not the pursuit of happiness, that these ideas will provide plenty of encouragement for us as we face the challenges of today. Thank you.
Yes, Doctor. You spoke of how the Muslim world, the radicals, look at majority versus minority. How does the majority or the Muslims in a whole view the radicals? To me, it seems quite strange that they could even support some man sitting in a cave, totally detached from this society and trying to change the world that he has really limited contact with.
Let me repeat the question just to make sure I understand it. Is the question, what do the majority Muslim world think of the radicals?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Well, the radicals don't really care. They don't really care. For the radicals, these leaders and the communities they rule are corrupt. I had a remarkable conversation with one such radical a few years ago who was absolutely focused. And I mentioned several leaders in the Muslim world, even leaders who, including Iran, who are very anti-American, and he was dismissive of them. He was dismissive. He said, they don't matter. They don't matter. He said, Iran, how can I trust Iran? I said, what do you mean? They're very anti-American. You run to trust them. No, he said. Look at what they did with the Northern Alliance in the invasion of Afghanistan. They supported the Northern Alliance, which was on the side of the United States. You know, I read the New York Times. I remember when he said that, but I never thought about it in those terms. So the radicals are very smart. They're very clear. They know what they want. I felt I didn't have enough time to talk to this guy, but the only way to engage him is to engage him on the level of values that, you know, America may be bad, but he's living in America, earning a living, supporting his family, and going about his business. Nobody's bothering him. So America has some redeeming qualities, after all, even for him.
Uh,
But I guess my question is, doesn't the minority, in a sense, need the majority to come into power? Because if we look at Iran, for instance, we had Khomeini in the Iranian Revolution, where he introduced the concept of Velayat al-Faqih, and he talked about, he kind of introduced an idea which was very much in line with the Shia way of thinking. So it was a very shrewd political maneuver. And in a sense, it was widely accepted, and it kind of helped in the success of the Iranian Revolution. So my question is, don't they need, doesn't the minority, in a sense, need the majority in order to succeed and stay in power?
Yeah, that's a very important question. Because the heart of that question is, if I may cast it another way, just to show how important it is that permanent revolution is really permanent chaos, is permanent anarchy. If a revolution is going to be successful and meaningful, it has to have a direction, right? It has to have a goal to achieve something. If you're going to, for example, isolate yourself from society, and so you don't want to have anything to do with it because society is corrupt, then you become, historically speaking, a relic, a museum piece. You may be interesting for curious and collectors, like Shaker furniture in our museums, but you don't play any role in the mainstream at all. So you're absolutely right. And what you want then to say to the radicals, a follow-up to that question, is, what kind of society do you want? If, let's assume you can get what you want, we'll give you everything you want, what would it look like? What kind of society would you want? The Taliban in Afghanistan, that's a nightmare. That's a nightmare. So yeah, you are right. And at that point, we have to deal with questions of ideas and values. Ideas are very, very powerful. And I really cannot stress the importance of Americans being clear about the core ideas and values that make this country what it is. You know, I was coming from the Library of Congress. I had been in the archives. I came out in the evening. I'm very disoriented. I have no idea where I am, literally. If you asked me to point you in any direction, I would be hopeless. I get completely submerged by history. I came out, hailed a taxi. The driver was a Pakistani taxi driver. He had lived in Iran as a taxi driver, in Iraq, in Syria, in France, in Spain. He came to the United States. He didn't know who I was. He didn't know who I was. We started talking. I was interested in Islam. We talked a little bit about that. He was so excited. He opened his cubbyhole of his car, his took out photographs of his children. His daughter was playing soccer in a Maryland school. And he said to me, this is the greatest country in the world. This is the greatest country in the world. He was so thrilled. He was shaking. He said, my daughter one day will become a doctor. This is the greatest country in the world. And I thought, I couldn't tell my colleagues at Yale. You know, that this guy is so enthusiastic about America, because we are so hard on America, aren't we? We beat up on America. We beat up on ourselves. And that's the freedom America gives us, to beat up on America. But this guy was a new immigrant in the United States. He saw his daughter. He's a mayor taxi driver. One day, his daughter is going to be a surgeon. America will make that possible for him. So I say, yeah, these are the ideas I want to struggle with and argue with. But we, as Americans, must be clear about the ideas and values that have shaped us and defined us. You know, when I spoke to these radicals, America the Great Satan, full of hatred and venom, I said, I should have to have dinner with you. Oh, no, they said, we have to get our flight this evening. But they said to me, when you go back to America, can you help get a scholarship for our children? The same people who had been heaping coals of fire on America's head. So there are things that are appealing, you know, about America, even for the radicals.
Uh, Professor, I don't consider myself religious, but I do have some concerns, what I see as an American citizen in the last 15 years about the rise of the so-called religious right and in this country. And my fundamental fear is, and it's a question related to you on this, is I fear that regardless of what religion a person holds, when they hold to this theory of doctrinal infallibility with their sacred texts, that seems to trump, to use your word, any sort of compromise or minority rights. And I would like to know your feelings on that, if in fact a religion became the majority power in this country, how would you feel that the minorities, whether they be agnostic, atheist, or just a different religious creed, would possibly suffer with the majority holding a view of infallibility, meaning that it would trump anything else as far as compromise?
I hope I'm not naive when I say that I'm less troubled by that prospect transpiring in America. America is too complex as a political system, with the Constitution, with the amendments, the Bill of Rights, with what you might call participatory democracy, so that there is a cycle of elections every 2 years, every 4 years. New interests, new combinations rise. They filter out the old stuff and refresh the whole sort of stream of national life. Immigrants come in, they come out. Hispanic immigrants, Caribbean immigrants, Asian immigrants, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and so on and so on. America is too vibrant and too dynamic for it to be held hostage to one idea or one ideology. I really, you know, if you think of the early republic, I said this, by the way, in a conversation with Justice Breyer of the Supreme Court. I said, I am struck by one thing when I read the historical sources, early America, that the founding fathers were absolutely convinced that America will succeed. When no one else in the whole world believed them. No one else believed them. Washington was a fetid pool of insects. The Europeans said is a city of elegant spaces. There's nothing there. But these Americans were convinced that America would succeed. I'm really stunned by that. And I asked him, I asked Justice Breyer. He took out of his pocket the new European Constitution, 300 pages, 400 pages, I don't know, 500 pages. And he said, the idea of America is summarized by Madison in a few pages. And what is astonishing about that is that these ideas, succinct, brief, have lasted through these centuries. He said, if you don't mind me, when I go to Europe, I shall cite this evidence. You see what I'm trying to say? America is too vibrant. I honestly do not believe. And to go to the religious right itself, you know, they say they want to kind of go back to New Testament Christianity or fundamentally. They don't have that. All we have in Christianity is a translated religion. That's all we have in Christianity. And a translated religion is necessarily interpreted. And once you start interpreting Christianity in a particular way, you provoke a counter-interpretation. And America is full of that. So that's why I'm not so worried. I hope I'm right. you had a question.
Good evening, Professor. Mm-hmm. I was just you know, I found that the point that you made about eventually we will actually have to deal with these problems with ideas and values, that, you know, we wouldn't be able to fight about it, that it'll come down to ideas and values. So I was thinking that in the present state that we're in as a society, where a lot of people, I feel, are apathetic. You're like, well, I don't really care, you know, like, I believe this and that's fine, you know, and, you know, a lot of people are hesitant to talk about these kinds of ideas, about values and stuff. Like, I have my values, but, you know, I'm not going to talk about it. And I know religion is a sensitive area. So, you know, some people are actually very hesitant to do that because they don't want to offend anybody, understandably so. So I feel that this, the process that has to occur in order for us to really start talking productively about ideas and values, you know, is it may see a little trouble with the present state of, well, you know, this hesitance that, you know, derives from apathy, derives from an unwillingness to challenge, to allow ourselves to be challenged. I just feel that, well, the question is, do you think that we as a society, I'm talking about the West, need to develop our ability to have productive, constructive conversation about ideas and values? Do you think that we as a society need to work on that first before we can actually see any real solutions to the bigger problems?
Yeah, I think so, and I have some concrete ideas about that. I think all of us should study at least three books in terms of American ideas and values. One is A Life of George Washington. The second is A Life of Abraham Lincoln. And the third is De Tocqueville's Democracy in America. Start there. I think some of us here in the audience, young people, will be amazed at the faith of someone like Washington in the idea of America before there was anything going for it. You'll be amazed. A third of the so-called Continental Army had no shoes, and they're fighting the British, trudged through the snow to Valley Forge. Washington was wary about asking for more money or more power because he didn't want to encroach on the rights and the freedoms of Americans. America works as an idea not only because America is a political community, but America is also a moral community. And the moral and the political, that is to say, principle and expedience, do overlap in American life. Americans are pragmatic, they are also very idealistic. My brother was ill, he needed surgery. I called the doctor up, he said, I'll perform the surgery free of charge. But you must call the hospital, because I have to do it in a hospital. I called the hospital, spoke to the head of surgery, Yale New Haven Hospital. Oh, fine. They don't know my brother. Never met him. He came over, performed the surgery. Off he went. No strings attached. No strings attached. America works not only when we take what is our right, but when we give something back. So, yeah, I say begin with those three books. You had a question, sorry.
This is, Doctor, partly in response to that first question, there a point I didn't quite get. I would like to know, and this is speculative on your part, how much support do you feel that the moderates, the seculars, the silent Muslims feel towards the goal of the radicals in establishing a Shia-type Muslim society throughout the world, the goal? They're not saying anything because they don't want to get blown
into
up.
Trouble. Yes.
And they don't want to lose their jobs. Yeah. And get, but what do you think is the current, the underlying current?
Yeah, I mean, there is sympathy for the radical idea of bringing back the good old days. If the prayer is, thy will be done in heaven as it once was on earth, yeah, many Muslims would resonate with that idea. The idea that we can fashion a new world, a new society, by working hard with one another and helping one another without any strings attached, that's a radical idea. But I believe in that idea. I was summoned 2 years ago to Oxford to speak to the directors of Oxfam in Oxford. They had come up against this issue of values and ideas, because they see themselves as a secular NGO. Yeah? They're not going to get into values and things. And I said to them that that puts them in a very defensive position against the radical, because the radicals can take the initiative and set the agenda. If you don't have any ideas you want to promote, then you've left a vacuum. Don't complain if other people say they have ideas they want to fill the vacuum with. You can't complain because you say you don't have any. So I said to them that it would be a mistake, even for Oxfam, to give up on the fact that the Western achievement is worth defending. It's worth defending with all its inadequacies, with all its shortcomings, with everything that's wrong with it, precisely for that reason. Not because the West has achieved a utopia, but because from the clash of ideas and values, the West has decided that certain goals are worth striving for and other goals are not. That building community, building hope, building trust, building schools, taking care of the sick, of the disabled, we don't do it well, but that direction is better than one of callousness, of indifference, of selfishness and self-centeredness. So the West has something going for it, and Oxfam had better stand up for that. Otherwise, Oxfam is going to get mowed over in the world of the radicals. So I would say, yeah, there is a certain resonance. But maybe there are many among the moderates who sympathize with us in the West. They should not leave the West to fight this battle by itself. And I have some ideas about that, too, how the West must appeal to friends in the Muslim world to join us in this struggle. It's a struggle of ideas. And I have very simple ways to demonstrate this, very, very simple suggestions. On the anniversary of 9/11 or any other horrible massacre, there should be convened an interfaith council of the ulema, of imams, of rabbis, and of priests and ministers and pastors and other community leaders to stage an act of public condemnation of these acts of violence and to pray for the victims and their families. It doesn't cost any money. I am prepared to pay for the soda that's required to refresh the participants. It won't cost much money. But the symbol of that would be very powerful.
My question is on American foreign policy and improving the image of the United States around the world and, you know, the image that Muslim extremists may have. I was just wondering what the American government could do to improve the image of our country abroad. And there's a reluctance to speak directly to Muslim extremists who are a minority of the population. And the government doesn't want to cooperate with those groups, and they also, the minorities also discount the like Middle Eastern governments. And I was just wondering what sort of decisions and moves we could make.
I have to say to you that you don't know it, but the United States government has been doing a lot in helping out in the Muslim world, working with those groups that you mentioned. And in the nature of the of that kind, those projects, the government can't talk about them, you see, openly. So you and I don't know about them. But they are taking place. There's a lot of give and take. See, I say to my radical friends, this image that America is anti-Muslim, anti-Islam, I say it's a caricature. It's not true. Americans do not believe in enemies. Americans believe in themselves. Americans don't know what to do with enemies. They don't know. They really don't know what to do with enemies. So they say, let's give them money so they can become our friends. And when they don't become our friends, we are puzzled. Why? 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 We gave you money. Why?
Thank you very much for this really provocative presentation. I find your optimism about America quite unusual, actually. And my question is this, that since the Enlightenment in the West, one of the primary values has been an ability to think critically about our values. One of the core values since the Enlightenment and part of modernity in the West has been this self-critical reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And this relates to a question that the gentleman asked earlier. How do you have that core value of self-critical reflection and dialogue about core values when your dialogue partner is absolutely convinced that they are right and you are wrong?
Yeah, I suppose Americans would say that critical tools of analysis must be used simply as tools rather than as substitutes for values. In a brilliant article on George Santayana, who's a philosopher at Harvard, Lionel Trilling at Columbia said that Santayana did not understand something about America. And that is that Americans love to look around, to explore, adventure. Americans love to look deep into things, to analyze, to criticize. But Americans do not like to look down upon. And he said this is something that Santayana did not really understand. And so he felt ill at ease in America. Because in America, there are not these divisions into classes, intellectuals, commoners, and so forth. In fact, Tocqueville says that expert ideas give Americans the heebie-jeebies. That's my vernacular translation of Tocqueville. Americans don't like the idea that government shall be a government of experts. And Tocqueville says the American remedy is popular democracy and the jury system. He said Europeans would be floored by the notion that a person is entitled to a jury of his or her peers. You know, but that's American justice. And so we take these ideas of self-criticism and values, etc., but we balance them against the idea that everyone's opinion counts. It's the open town meeting, the New England Town Assembly, right? Everyone's opinion counts. And when Europeans heard that a wrestler became governor of Minnesota, and two movie stars, one movie star became president of the United States, and another movie star became governor of California, they're puzzled by this. Americans love that. And it seems to me you have to balance those two. And I say this as someone who has taught most of his professional life at Harvard and at Yale. I also served on the Pew Charitable Trust Foundation giving advice. I was struck at the press in Philadelphia how often the trust would say, let us be inclusive, let us include as many voices in the grant making, we gave millions of dollars over the years, as we can. Everybody should have a shot at this. That's very American. And so I would say we academics who like to be self-critical, and so in a sense we are very self-indulgent. We're very self-indulgent. You know, I am paid by Yale. I don't have to answer to anybody. But I'm also a practicing Christian, and I feel my obligation is bigger than that. I owe something to the society. I owe something to make life better for others. I have a responsibility. I have to be accountable to my conscience. By the way, that was Madison's definition of a liberal democracy, that a liberal democracy is strong and powerful because of the free consent of the citizens, not because we are compelled, but because you and I are free to look after our neighbor. You know, we had a snowstorm right on Friday. I came, drove home, and there was a woman, my neighbor, who was busy trying to shovel snow. And I thought, I want to go and help. Should I? Or is this interfering in somebody else's life? Should I? And I sat there in my car for about 10 minutes trying to decide what to do. And I went inside, I put on my gloves again, I came back and I came outside and I said, Karen, do you need a hand? I just couldn't live with myself. I just couldn't do it. Now, there's no law that says I should do it. You see what I mean? But there is something about conscience that says to you, if you see something that's right, you must do it. Because if you don't, you'll be condemned. And that would say that's part of being an American. Thank you.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Sana. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I just wanted to present you with a token of appreciation for participating in tonight's event. This concludes our presentation. Please feel free to stay around for the follow-up student-led discussion. Thank you.